This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from Dogen's 300 Koan Shoba Genzo, Case 101. Nanwei's, it's not like something. Zen Master Nanwei went to study with the sixth ancestor, Huanung. Sixth ancestor said, "Where are you from?" Nanwei said, "I come from national teacher Huayan." The sixth ancestor said, "What is it that has come like this?" Nanwei could not answer. He attended on the master for 8 years and worked on this question. One day he said to the sixth ancestor, "Now I understand it. When I first came to study with you, you asked me, what is it that has come like this?" The sixth ancestor said, "How do you understand it?" Nanwei said, "To say it's like something misses it." Huanong said, "Does it depend on practice and enlightenment?" Nanwei said, "It's not that there is no practice and enlightenment. It's just that we should not be defiled by them." The sixth ancestor said, "Just this non-defilement is what Buddhas have maintained and transmitted. You are like this. I am like this. All the ancestors in India were like this." Commentary. To set up monasteries and establish the teachings is like adding flowers to brocade. The wisdom that has no teacher pervades the whole universe, reaches everywhere. When it's truly seen, you go deaf, dumb, and blind. What is there to compare this to? How can it be expressed? Indeed, how can it be understood? Take off the blinders, set down the backpack. This is the peaceful dwelling. This is why it is said the 10,000 sages have not transmitted a single particle of the truth. Yet students throughout the world labor over appearances and grasp at reflections. Tell me, since it's not transmitted, then why are there so many complicated koans and teachings? The verse. Blue sky, bright sun. There is no distinguishing east from west. Yet acting in accord with the imperative still requires dispensing medicine when the sickness appears. So we're coming to the near to the end of this Ango. Sean, I think it was mentioned in her talk that sort of taking a while during the Ango to kind of connect with Buddha ancestors, and some others have mentioned this, and I'm sure it's true for many. I think in my early training, you know, when Dada Roshi spoke about ancestors and other things, you know, not only did I not understand what he was talking about, but it didn't necessarily like grab me. It was like, whatever. it just wasn't alive for me yet. And, you know, that's a really important part of training, is that we, you know, by necessity and importantly, we when we encounter the Dharma, we, you know, there's some affinity, otherwise we wouldn't be here. And so there's a resonance, there's a strength in that, and we feel maybe some drawing in, being drawn in. And that means to whatever those elements are that we're being drawn to. And if we just left it at that, then, you know, our understanding would be very narrow, because those are just certain aspects. And so it's really important that we encounter in throughout our training things that don't speak to us yet. Things that we don't understand, things that we may not understand why, like, why is this important? You know, for me, it was like, yeah, I know that we got here through people before us. Like, I can, you know, deduce that. That makes sense. But they're back there. They were, I am, and it's my suffering, it's my questions, it's my life that I'm trying to sort out. And so clearly I was not seeing a connection. And that happens all over the place. You know, there are lots of things we don't see the connection. And for some things that may always be true. There are certain things we just don't connect with. It's just not our temperament, it's not our time, it just doesn't speak to us. And there are other things, hopefully many things, that start out that way, but that change over time, that we begin to understand more about what that actually is and how that relates directly to ourselves, and something comes to life. And in that way, then our experience of this Dharma becomes larger and more multifaceted, more nuanced, more beautiful. And really what that means is that our own sense of what we are as beings and what this world is becomes more multifaceted, nuanced, and beautiful. This question that Huainong asks, this is very early, of course, in the development of Zen, the first few generations. And so this question that he asks, what is it that has come like this? You know, there are some questions that we have to study to understand what does this question mean, so that we can understand the significance of the question. Because if we just sort of take our ordinary gloss of it based on, you know, these are English words that appear in English, I speak English, so this is what it must mean, that's not often going to help us very much, because these questions often are based in teachings and understandings that we need to study. So the Tathagata, the Buddha, Tathagata means the one thus come, and it also means the one thus gone. I was telling somebody recently, or some people, when we were in India, one day we were talking to Niraj, who was this really beautiful young guy who was our guide, and for 2 of the weeks we traveled together on a bus and were with each other all day, every day. And a really nice young guy, and he wasn't the guide we were supposed to get. We were supposed to get somebody else, but the other person couldn't make it. And so at the last minute, Niraj showed up, and we found out that he was pretty green. You know, he was, like, this was a big job for him. And that his employers were a little, like, not so sure he was ready for this, and he really fought for it. He said, no, please let me do this, I can do it. And he was great. He was really great. He made the trip even more wonderful. And so I was asking him one day, when we were in conversation, I said, Niraj, what is this? Right? This gesture that, you know, that I see, we're seeing all over. I said, what does that mean? And he goes, oh, it means yes. It means no. It means, and he just rattled off all of these things. You know, it's like... Okay, that, like, just, I don't know what that means. But everybody else seems to understand it. So the one thus come and the one thus gone. The one come who comes thus. The one who goes thus. So this is an epithet for the Buddha. The one who comes in suchness, who goes in suchness. Suchness is the reality of all things. It's the truth that is beyond coming and going. And, you know, when we speak about truth and reality, these, you know, big fat words, they suggest something, they can suggest something in our mind that is fixed, that is some sort of absolute, the truth, the reality. And it's very important to understand that it's not like that. It's not like something. And so these words, like in a sense all of the language of Buddhism, are just sort of bookmarks or placeholders to bring us to some closeness, to some approximation of something that we call truth and reality, which cannot be expressed in those words, but we have to express it. And so as we're training, we need to understand, as we're engaging these words and continue to release them, release those words, release these teachings in our mind from any fixedness that we might give them. In the passage that we've been working with, this Ango from Master Dogen, actualizing Buddha ancestors means to bring them forth and look at them in veneration. It's not limited to Buddhas of the past, present, and future, but it is going beyond Buddhas who are going beyond themselves. It's taking up those who have maintained the face and eye of Buddha ancestors, formally bowing and meeting them. They have manifested the virtue of the Buddha ancestors. They have dwelt in it, and they have actualized it in the body. This is such a marvelous passage. We could study this our whole lives, and in a sense, we are. I think this passage, the short passage, really beautifully expresses what we are doing in a way that connects us with everything before and everything to come and brings us right to this moment and makes it clear that there is the manifestation of virtue. There is dwelling in that, manifesting that, bringing that forth, and actualizing it in the body, living it. So everything we do really is this. You know, as I've said before, we don't, you know, when I was a musician, I would spend hours and hours and hours practicing, rehearsing for a performance. Right? Practice, 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 in solitude, alone, you know, or with my teacher. And then finally, performance. It's live. All of that building up for this. Practice here is all of that at once, at every moment. And so the way we bring forth the wisdom of the Buddhas is by manifesting wisdom in our thoughts, words, and actions. The way we bring forth the great compassion is by being compassionate now. We take up and maintain the face and eye of the Buddhas by being that face and eye, that body and mind, by bringing forth the bodhicitta that every sincere practitioner going back to the time of the Buddha brought forth. Practicing, in essence, the same practice. What did the Buddha practice? He practiced meditation. He practiced walking. One of the things that we were continually being amazed by is how much walking this person did. He walked a huge amount in his life. I mean, we were on buses, right? You know, no wonder he had back problems in his old age. In another fascicle, Dogen says, the actualization of Buddhas and ancestors is the real form of exhaustive investigation. We bring it forth, we actualize it through the real form of exhaustive investigation. This is an inquiring tradition. We bring forth faith, we practice great compassion, we bring forth all of these enlightened qualities, we practice the precepts. But it is the investigation that makes it Buddha Dharma. It is the investigation that makes it the Buddha way. And what that means is that we are in a dynamic relationship with things, with our mind, with our zazen, with the Dharma, with things that we don't understand, with things that we don't get. Like, why is this important? I don't really get it. It doesn't speak to me. Okay, that's just a place to start. Now, examine it. That was part of the spirit behind Dada Roshi's creation of the Eight Gates, is if we're going to do these things, let's not just do them because we're doing them, but let's examine them. What are we doing? What is liturgy? All phenomena are the forms of suchness, are the nature of suchness, are the body of suchness, are the mind of suchness, all phenomena, all things. Are the world of suchness, are the clouds and rain of suchness, the walking, standing, sitting, and lying down of suchness, the sorrow and joy, the excitement and the calm. They are the staff and whisk of suchness. They are the flower twirling and smiling of suchness. They are the Dharma transmission and the intent to transmit of suchness. They are the study and practice of suchness. They are the pine-like constancy and the bamboo-like interruptedness of suchness. The interruptedness of bamboo is the nodes, and sometimes that's used to refer to sort of barriers or entanglements. All dharmas are forms of emptiness. Forms of emptiness is another way of speaking of suchness, is another way of speaking of thus. The merging, the unity of every opposite, every duality. We capture all that by speaking of it in terms of relative and absolute. Relative is phenomena, everything that we can know, touch, taste, feel, think, experience. The absolute is that which has no body, no characteristic, no time and space. Each abides in its own dharma state. You are like this, I am like this. And so for 6 years, not 8 years, Nan Wei was working on this question. What is it that has come like this? In appearing, when a thought appears, it seems to be born, right? It wasn't there a moment ago. Now something is. So from apparent nothingness, now something is. There is somethingness. There's a sense of existence having come into being. Or a baby being born. Before the egg was fertilized, there was nothing. There was nothing. Now there's something, a person. What is it that has come like this? Is that the way it is? Is there nothing? And then suddenly there is something? And then there is nothing again? Is that what death is? Is death having come from nothing, having spent a certain amount of time being something, and then once again being nothing? What is this that has come? And so Nan Wei was working on this, and he comes forth and he says, now I understand. And Wei Nong says, what do you understand? He says, to say it's like something misses it. Now that could be understood by, you know, any, you know, Buddhist student after a month or so of study, right? Words don't convey the truth. To say it's like something misses it, we can understand that. But Nan Wei is speaking at a much deeper level than that. But the sixth ancestor wants to probe, so he says, does it depend on practice and enlightenment? Is what you have experienced a result of your practice and enlightenment? A very, very important question. Right. I mean, that's often why we get so frustrated, is because we're trying to use our practice to create something, a state of mind, a state of being, an absence of certain states of mind and states of being that are a result of our practice, and then once we obtain them, we need to retain them, right? But what happens? Not that. You lose them. Right? Whether today or in the next moment or after session is over, whatever that was is now not. What is it that has come thus? So when he says, does it depend on practice and enlightenment? Is your understanding, is your liberation dependent on practice and alignment? Nan Wei said, it's not that there is no practice and alignment. It's just that we should not be defiled by them. Right? That should turn us on our head. Because normally we think, well, wait a minute, practice and alignment are to free us of our defilements. And here he's saying, don't be defiled by practice and enlightenment. And then Huainong says, just this non-defilement is what Buddhas have maintained and transmitted. So I wanted to look at this, hopefully, and briefly, through Master Dongshan's five ranks as a way of talking a little bit about training and how it wakes us. And I was thinking of a story as a way of in the Mahapadanibbana Sutta that kind of, I think, shows this very nicely. When the Buddha was in his final days, he one day was in the company of a lay practitioner named Kunda, who was a silversmith. And Kunda invited the Buddha and his Sangha to lunch the next day, to their meal. So the Buddha said yes. And so Kunda went home and got busy making a whole bunch of probably really good food. I always think of these meals, you know. Like, what would you serve the Buddha, right? I mean, not bologna. Something special. So so they came, and they all sit down, and the Buddha sees what's being served, and he calls Kunda over, and he says, Kunda, one of the things that the Kunda had made was something called a pig delicacy. And the translator said, now that could be something made of pork, some sort of delicacy, or it could be something that pigs really loved. Either way. But the Buddha calls Kunda over and says, listen, that pig delicacy, I want you to serve it just to me. Don't serve it to anybody else. And serve the other monks all the other food you have. And Kunda says, okay. And so he serves all the food. And then the Buddha calls him over and says, now, take all of that pig delicacy and bury it. Don't let anybody else eat it. Okay? So basically get rid of it. And what he says is, I don't see anyone in the world in whom, if when this is ingested, it would go to a healthy change. It would be good for them, aside from the Tathagata, the Buddha. And so he eats it, and Kunda buries all of the remains of this. And then after the meal, they left. And then it says, and then in the Blessed One, after he'd eaten Kunda's meal, there arose a severe disease accompanied with the passing of blood, intense pains, and deadly. So, food poisoning, perhaps. And it says, but the Blessed One endured it, mindful, alert, and was not struck down. So what is the merging of relative and absolute? It's every moment, everything. And it's already in every moment and everything. It is the fundamental nature. It is also something that we are practicing. We are practicing within what we call the relative and absolute. How could we not, if it is the nature of all things? But we are also practicing to, in a sense, and excuse the inadequacy of the language, moving towards, bringing forth into not this moment, because it's already fully manifest, but into our realized mind. And so here the Buddha is sick, severely sick, a relative experience. Right? And he, with his understanding of mind and body and sickness and pain and the real nature of things, not only endures it, but is mindful, alert, and is not struck down, and basically heals himself. Now, this is not to say that every enlightened being has the power to heal themselves. Right? There have been awakened beings who died of diseases, and that will continue. But here, the Buddha was able to transform that disease. And then what's interesting is the Buddha calls Ananda over and says, listen, because remember, he's getting ready to die. And so he's taking care of things. And so he says, listen, if anyone tries to guilt Kunda and say, hey, you killed the Buddha, right? You fed him his last meal before he died, before he entered Parinirvana. And he got sick, right? You can just imagine, right, how that's going to go over when people find out. And so he says, listen to Ananda. He says, tell people that when they start blaming Kunda, that there are two offerings of food to an enlightened being that are especially auspicious. One is right before they're enlightened, and the other is right before they die. So in fact, Kunda has created tremendously powerful karma, merit, by doing this. Because, of course, he wasn't intending to make the Buddha sick. And so the Buddha here, in his final moments, is bringing forth this great compassion, recognizing, you know, how this could go. And so how do we practice and move, in a sense, into suchness? And so Master Dongshan's five ranks, which are a way of talking about and teaching, like, how do we understand? So we live in what we call the relative, the phenomenal world, everything that we can touch and recognize and measure and talk about, right? And we're here, we come into practice, bodhicitta arises because on some level, we, and not just we as Buddhists, but human beings since the beginning of time, have sensed that there is something else here that we're in the midst of, or that is obtainable, or that somehow we can touch, that is of another realm. And whether you call that God, or the absolute, or truth, or the fundamental, that since the beginning of time, it seems that people have sensed that, which is pretty interesting, since you can't see it, you can't touch it. But it is nothing but our own nature. So is it like that part of our nature that is somehow reaching up, bubbling up, right, coming into our, not so much our thinking mind, but our sensing on some level that we don't understand, can't explain, but can't deny. And so what are the relationships between these two realities, these two realms, right? That which we know and that which we sense and can't know, but have a sense that something essential about our lives is dependent upon. And so we seek. And so the first of the ranks, and you could think of these as ranks or just aspects, views in, is relative within the absolute. And the poem, part of the poem is, in the third watch of the night, before the moon appears, no wonder when we meet there is no recognition. The third watch of the night is the darkest hour. No moon, no stars, absolute darkness. Nothing can be discerned. You can't raise your hand and see it. No wonder when we meet here in this place, we don't recognize each other. It can't be seen. When we see moment after moment after moment the constructions of our mind, worlds appear and disappear, memories, people, situations, wars and truces, what is it when that stops? What remains? When the mind is no longer constructing, no longer bringing forth, what is it? When all self-awareness, all sense of inside and outside, all sensation, it's not a matter of has been stopped, because that's just more construction, but cannot be found. when there is no more creating such that there is nothing more to be found. The empty sky vanishes, the iron mountain crumbles. The Buddha said, things here are not as they seem. And so when we're practicing and stepping into, moving into silence, practicing stillness, these are aspects. In a way, this is how to step forward towards that darkest hour, that ceasing construction. I mean, that's why we get so exhausted, is we're working so damn much. Working, 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 working. Building worlds, tearing them down. Building worlds, tearing them down. You deserve a rest. Everybody deserves a good, true rest. And so isn't it curious that we come to Sesshin, which is so effortful, to rest. And so the Buddha said, how do we construct? Stop avoiding, stop denying, stop suppressing, stop stopping, stop destroying, and stop preserving, lingering, retaining, controlling. When the 10,000 dharmas are without self, Dogen says, there's no delusion, no enlightenment, no Buddhas, no creatures, no life, no death. Hakuin of this says, even though you remain absorbed in this state, this place of the darkest hour, no suffering, no cause of suffering, no old age and death, you will never get out of the cave of self-complacency and the inferior fruits of this state. Essential though it is, true though it is still incomplete, it's inferior. Therefore, it is said, those whose activity does not leave this place sinks into a poisonous sea, which is just another way of saying training continues. Continues. The path is endless. And so the next rank is the absolute within the relative. What is that reality in its relationship to phenomena? In that first rank, there is no phenomena. And remember, this is not something that is created. You can't even say it's a state of mind, but it is a direct experience. And so absolute within the relative is how then do we start to reckon with the world? And the poem says, a sleepy-eyed grandma encounters herself in an old mirror. Clearly she sees a face, but it doesn't resemble hers. She sees a face, but it's not her face. Encountering herself in an old mirror. Everywhere you look, you see yourself, but it's not you. It's not yourself. It's a face, but it's not your historical, familiar face. All phenomena are just this. And so this is where we begin to see the real nature of things, you, thoughts, emotions, actions, consequences, creatures, inanimate objects, events, their solidity, their permanence, their self is realized as empty. Hakuin says, all the myriad phenomena before your eyes, the old and the young, the honorable and the base, halls and pavilions, verandas, corridors, plants, trees, mountains, rivers. You regard these as your original, true, and pure aspect. This is the realization of Mu. This is Zhaozhou's oak tree in the garden. But Hakuin says you cannot stay in this realization because here you are not yet conversant with the deportment of the bodhisattva, which is a very sort of gussied up way of saying there's no compassion. You're not yet conversant, right? Engaging, manifesting the deportment of the bodhisattva, nor does one understand the causal conditions for a Buddha field. Although you have a clear understanding of the universal, you cannot cause it to shine forth in a way that understands the unobstructed interpenetration of the manifold dharmas. In other words, we'll still be confused and confounded and challenged by the world, which is just another way of saying training continues. And so the next rank is coming from within the real. And this is really the first step of coming forth. And so coming off of the cushion into kinhin. Coming off of the cushion into liturgy. Coming off of the cushion into work practice. Into dishgru. Into relating with each other. Into having a responsibility. I remember years ago, there was a Jikido sitting. We were in Sesshin, and there was something that needed to happen. It was her responsibility. She was sitting. And so I went up and tapped on her shoulder. And she said, "Don't bother me. I'm practicing." And so this is stepping off the 100-foot pole, moving into the world, the real world, dust, people, egos, what Trungpa Rinpoche called ego diarrhea, right? Kind of sums it up. I mean, it doesn't always take the form of diarrhea. But sometimes. How does that which does not come forth, come forth? How does the one who cannot die pass from this life? How does empty space, a cloud body, move, walk, think, love, relate? And so this is the first stepping forth. And so a practice like kinhin is at the stage of training where we are, it is a meditation practice. It is a mindfulness practice, right? But in that very moment, it is, can you maintain that mindfulness and move? Can mindfulness move? And then as you go further into this air, into this stage, it is, can you move without moving your feet? How does the one who has no body move in a body? Hakuin says, "We must know the moment of the meeting of paired opposites, bright and dark. We must go to that place. We must see how does light and dark meet, good and evil, all of these opposites. What does that even mean, to meet? Is that actually what's happening? Or is that just the straining of our language to express something?" And so this means we have to enter the realm of people. It means, so I was saying the other day, just a few minutes ago. We have to enter into the realm of things we don't understand. In a word, we have to be challenged. We have to be challenged, which means we're going to be uncomfortable. So if you're in training and you're never uncomfortable, I apologize. You're being cheated, or you're perfectly enlightened. But I'm not sure anybody would fall into that category of not being challenged. That's how we meet the limit of our mind, the limit of our practice. Not the limit as in the limit, but just what we could call an edge, which really just means training continues. And then we move towards mutual integration. The poem here is, the poem for the third rank, I didn't say, within nothingness there is a path leading away from the dusts of the world. Leading into the dusts of the world. And so when you know, you ask, as everyone should and does, how do I integrate this in my life? This is exactly what this is about. This is exactly what Dongshan is talking about. This is what training is for. This is what we are doing every day in training. Mutual integration, the poem is, when two blades cross points, there's no need to withdraw. I've always loved that line. When two blades cross point, what would be a conflict, what would be two sides coming together, there's no need to withdraw. It's not as it appears. How is light and dark intermingle? Within light there is darkness, but don't look for that light. Within darkness there is light, but don't look, don't expect to find it. And this is also where the bodhisattva's enthusiasm, joy, for what had been, you know, the burdens of the world, is now seen in a very different way, as endless possibilities. And here, distinctions and boundaries and divisions, all the stuff of our suffering are seen. Things are not as they seem. And nor are they otherwise. When they meet, don't withdraw. When they seem real and solid and fixed, they cause so much pain. We bludgeon each other with our delusion, and we are bludgeoned, in a sense, with our own delusion. Each and every person, each and everything is one unified. One master called it undivided appearance emptiness, one word. Hojin Sensei yesterday talked about barriers, right, as gates. This is where we really begin to see that as truth. Dogen says, just Buddha with Buddha is now able to exhaustively investigate the real form of phenomena. Just Buddha with Buddha. The ocean and its waves is all ocean. It's all waves. It's all suchness. It's just Buddha with Buddha. Hakuin says, still, the student shouldn't consider this state to be a final resting place. Therefore, it said, such a person has in and of themselves a heaven-soaring spirit. And this, in this, along the way, what's happening, what part of what's transforming, is the burden of practice. You know, like, gotta go take my medicine, to the joy of practice. From the burden of delusion of things not yet seen. Oh, I'm still inadequate. I'm still insufficient. To being enlivening. There's more. Oh my God, there's more. What must they do in the end, Hakuin says? They must know that there is one more rank, unity attained. And here the poem is, who dares to equal her? Who falls into neither being nor non-being? Everyone wants to leave the current of ordinary life. Everyone. But this one, after all, comes back to sit amongst the coals and the ashes. Having tried to get away for so long, now we return to sit in the coals and ashes. Where else would you go? Where would you get away from them? Which is just another way of saying, training continues. The path is endless. Hallelujah. Not because it's good for you, but just because it is. It is not like something. At the end of the Buddha's life, Ananda, when the Buddha was laying down and they'd prepared a place for him to die, and the Sangha had gathered, much of the Sangha had gathered, Ananda, having attended to the Buddha for 40 years, been with him day after day after day after day after day after day after day, he left while all the other students were there sitting in the presence of the Buddha, and stood leaning against a door jamb, weeping, and said, "Here I am, still in training with work left to do, and the total unbinding of my teacher is about to occur, the teacher who has had such sympathy for me." It's such a perfect human moment. He is so sad that he is losing his teacher, and he is so concerned about himself. But it's a good concern. It's an important concern, right? All of those years with the Buddha, and the Buddha's sympathy for him was for him to do what he needed to do. And so the Buddha looks around and says, "Hey, where's Ananda?" And one of the monks says, "He's over there leaning against a door jamb, weeping." And so the Buddha says, "Tell him to come in my name. I want to see him." And so the monk goes over to the Ananda and says, "The master calls you in his name. He wants to see you." And so he goes over and sits down with the Buddha. And the Buddha says, "Enough, Ananda. Don't grieve. Don't lament. Haven't I already taught you that the state of growing different with regard to all things dear, all things appealing, that the state of becoming separate, the state of becoming otherwise, life and death, young and old, healthy and sick, what else is there to expect? What else is there in this life? It's impossible that one could forbid anything born and existing and fabricated and subject to disintegration from disintegrating. But he's also recognizing his grief." And he goes on to say, "For a long time, Ananda, you have waited on the Tathagata with bodily acts of goodwill, helpful, happy, wholehearted, without limit, with verbal acts of goodwill, with mental acts of goodwill, happy, healthy, wholehearted, and without limit. You are one who has made great merit. Commit yourself to exertion. Commit yourself to practice, and soon you will be free of that which binds you." How does the one free of all things love, care for another, recognize the grief, and respond? We should, you know, remember that whenever we encounter a teaching, if it's a true teaching, that somehow seems opaque or distant or dense or irrelevant, if it's a true teaching, if it's Dharma, that all of those are just signs that there's something we just need to keep training. We just need to keep examining, because all of it is about you and me, this life, this community, this world we're living in. The Buddha had no other concerns. It wasn't about building institutions. It wasn't about preserving. The only thing about it was about preserving was the harmony of the Sangha, so that people could practice. And that is our inheritance. And when we stay true to that, then the Sangha is healthy, the Dharma is radiant, and practice occurs. When we lose that a little bit or a lot, then that radiance begins to dim. And what the Buddha was doing in his last days and hours was his final offering to ensure to the best of his ability that all of, not that the work that he had done, it wasn't about preserving his legacy, it was about all that had been offered had been received and now resided within the bodies and minds of those who will continue living, because that's the job of the living, is to live. And so here we are, continuing in that great tradition. So in just that way, let's continue this The beginning of Ango and the end of Ango is a skillful means. Through it all, training occurs, it continues, it has no on and off. It's you, it's me. All of the ancestors are just like this.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.